The rest of you, if you would be so kind, and if you are able, either in body or spirit, if you could please stand with me. As God's people stood at the foot of a mountain, so too we just like to recognize that this is one of the primary places that God encounters us through his word and promises to be with us and speak to us through his word. And again, as I noted, we're going to start in verse 16. I'm stopping at verse 28. I know Paul gives a subsequent argument there on Jesus' resurrection, but I'm not getting into that today. And so I thought, you know, just for time's sake today, I would just stop there at verse 28. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks. Just pause there. One of the patterns you see in Acts is this. He finds sympathetic hearers amongst those who believe in God, and some of these are Jews, and some of these are Greeks who converted into Judaism. That's kind of the success of his ministry, is he always talks to people who kind of understand his worldview, and then he expands it out, and that's what you're seeing. And you see that throughout the whole book of Acts. So as well as in the marketplace, day by day with those who happen to be there, a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to debate with him. Some of them asked, what is this babbler trying to say? So clearly some of them write him off. But others, they remarked, he seems to be advocating foreign gods. Just pause there for a moment. Christians were seen as atheists in the ancient world. Christians were weird because they didn't believe in all these gods. They only believed in one. So they're like, what's wrong with you? But for this culture, they're like, the more gods, the merrier, right? Let's go. I said a few weeks ago, they collected them like Pez dispensers. And that's kind of what you see here going on. So he seems to be, and this is exciting for them, to be advocating for foreign gods. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about this man by the name of Jesus and his resurrection. So then they take him and they bring him into a meeting of the Areopagus, where they say to him, can we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and they like this, right? And we would like to know what they mean. And so all the Athenians and the foreigners who live there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. This group sounds fun, actually. But Paul then stood up in that meeting of the Areopagus and said, people of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around, I looked carefully at your objects of worship. I even found this over here, an altar with this inscription, to an unknown god. So you're clearly worshiping things you don't even know. So you're ignorant of the very things you worship, and so this is what I am going to say to you, proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the God of heaven and earth, and does not live in buildings, temples built by human hands. He's not served by human beings, human hands, as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life. He himself gives everyone breath and everything else. From one person, he made all the nations, that they should inhabit the entire earth and marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him. God did this so that perhaps they would even reach out for him and find him, though, and this is important if you understand the doctrine of the Spirit, though he is not far from any one of us, for in him we live. In him we move. In him we have our being. Even as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. These are the stunning words of God. You may be seated. So last week, if you recall, we said when you different than, say, you know, ancient creation myths, and even different than modern, you know, creation myths, sort of political, philosophical, how do you create a new world or utopia? Different than all of those, this story, the Bible, doesn't start with conflict. This story doesn't start with bloodshed. This story doesn't start with gods at war with one another. This story doesn't start with gods who die in order to bring about the world. This story doesn't start with lost appendages to bring about this place. This story, in fact, starts remarkably calm. And you see this even in that first verse of Genesis 1, which I think Acts 17 functions kind of as a commentary to it, and which is why I read it. But when you open the Bible up, it begins, "In the beginning, right? God created the heavens and the earth." There's in chapter 1, an order to things. There's a sort of rhythm to things. There's a structure to things that you don't find in other chapters of the Bible. You find it, and sometimes in the Psalms like this, but Genesis starts remarkably calm compared to ancient creation myths. It starts remarkably what we might call peaceful, and I think this has some real implications. And one of the first ones is clearly when you open the Bible, there's no rival to God. There's nobody at war with God for him to bring about this place. There's no challenger. There's nobody who, when he puts the sun into the sky, there's no moment when there's somebody else who say, "Take that sun down." There's none of that. You don't find any of that at the beginning. And there's something else that is implied in this opening passage, and even what Paul here is referring to, and that is, it was made on purpose. There was an intentionality to it. There's a reason for why this place is here rather than, say, not here. But there's one other implication to what Paul here speaks of in what we just read in Acts 17, but also here. And it implies a significant distinction, which is, I think, the core of all of Christian thought. And it's not the distinction that maybe we think of, like, darkness versus light, or light versus darkness, or God versus Satan, or God versus the devil, or the yin and the yang of reality. It's those aren't the distinctions that I'm talking about, but rather, and the distinction that Paul here brings up is God versus and compared to everything else. God and everything else he has made, which he lists heaven and earth, everything that falls under that. So the distinction, different than anything else you'll find in any other sort of creation myth, is there's a significant difference between this God and everything that he has made, which is often portrayed, and I'm going to show you a diagram. This is just a bit of a caveat. For me, when people put up diagrams, my eyes glaze over, and I'm a visual learner. Like, I like visual things, but like anytime you find these types of things, I just, like, especially when we're talking about God, it just seems so strange and weird that we're using these shapes and things like this to describe God. But this is not new. Like, I got this same diagram in high school, and I got this same diagram in college. I got this same diagram in seminary. This isn't new to me, right? And some of you have probably seen it to articulate this distinction, and that is the two circle. How many of you have seen this before? Of no? Nobody has seen it. Okay, all right. So this represents the difference between God and everything else, and even the different sizes imply something. Like, God is represented by the big circle. Everything he has made, including the heavens, are represented by the little circle, as if to say they're not the same thing. When we're talking about creation, all that God has made, and God, they're not equals, they're not co-equals. And then you see the lines that are connecting God and everything that he has made, because nowhere in the Bible does it ever suggest that this place and all of reality can exist without this God. Like, there's never a moment of time on this planet, in this universe, where everything isn't dependent on him, which is not the case the other way around. God is never dependent, say, on what he has made. And the reason I share this with you is because it's this distinction that sets the Bible story apart from every other story of even how to view reality in this way. But even today, right, not just dominant view of reality in the past, but dominant views of reality today. So, for example, a dominant view of reality today is there's nothing outside of this place. So this circle's big, and I don't mean big circle to mean God here, but everything in this world is all there is. This is all that exists, right? And this was, philosophers talked about this in the ancient world, and you can reduce everything to, you know, fire and water and air, but today we don't use that language. It's not as sophisticated, right? We have science, right? So basically everything can be reduced to, you know, matter, energy, wave packets, strings, and things like that. But notice how many circles there are. How many? One, because this is all there is. There's nothing beyond, there's nothing outside. Notice there's nothing sustaining it, and we don't even know why it's necessarily here, but there's nothing beyond this world. Now, I'm not here saying that some one-circle views don't believe in gods. Even the ancient cultures, they would have gods, but those gods weren't the god like this one that sustains everything and he's completely separate from. These would be like the Greek gods that are kind of like demigods, that are sort of like superheroes, so they're kind of tied to Earth in this way. But or when people even talk about Mother Earth, right? People will personify it, people will anthropomorphize it. But even somebody who believes in Mother Earth as kind of a its own deity and we got to care for her, if you were to say, yeah, but there's a God outside of Mother Earth who sustains everything and who made it out of nothing, this is something they would reject. So we would call this, and most people are in our culture, maybe one circle kinds of views of reality. Now, at this point, you might and should be asking, who cares? Why does any of this matter? Here's why. It means that the universe, it means that life, it means that this place never needed to happen. And it did. And not only that, you might be precious. I'm guessing you're precious to the people that love you. You might be gloriously precious to grandpa and grandma and to maybe your spouse and maybe to your friends, maybe your coworkers, maybe not as precious to them, but you're still precious to these people in your life. But I would argue you are gloriously and preciously unnecessary. You didn't need to be. And yet here you are. And here I am. Paul put it this way. The God who made the world and everything in it is the God of heaven and earth. And this God doesn't live in buildings built by humans. He's not served by humans as if this God was in need. Now let's slow down. Rather, he, God, notice the word, gives. He gives everyone life. He gives everyone breath. He gives everything else its life, and he gives everything else its breath, meaning he gave it. And he's arguing here, too, that this means, and he says this when he says he maps out their time and their place, God owns everything. He owns our time. He owns our abilities. He owns our talents. He owns our treasures. He owns our very selves in this way. And there's nothing we could ever add to God. There's nothing that God is in need of us. And what I'm trying to get at here is we're the ones in this story that are dependent. We're the ones in this story that are on the receiving end. And so what I'm trying to articulate here is that already in Genesis 1:1, using Acts 17 as our guide or as our commentary to Genesis 1:1, we're beginning to see something that shows up again and again and again and again and again in this story. And the word for it, and he says it there, is gift. Another word that we use, anybody know what other word we use for that in Christianity? It's another word that we use for gift. Grace. It shows up here. Now we typically think of, and rightly so, we typically think of grace when it comes to our salvation in Jesus, the blood that he has shed, our forgiveness of sins. But we first see the act of God's grace here. In chapter 1, verse 1, in this first verse, that he created, and I say that because he didn't have to. That is, in and of itself, what we mean when we say grace. And it's also why we say existence itself, just being alive, is a gift. And if you follow anything in terms of mental health and mental health awareness and stuff like this, and I'm not talking about healing from trauma, but I'm talking about one of the core health components of what makes a whole person. There are others, but I'll share one of them with you. It is gratitude. Like, it is at your core being a sense of thanksgiving. Now, why? No. Some people don't know why. It's just, it's a marker of what makes somebody whole. But from a Christian perspective, we do know why, because we are on the receiving end. Existence itself, breathing, life is a gift. And it's through God's grace. that we, yeah, receive, obviously, we're born, and we talk about this when it comes to the gospel, born of water and the Spirit, but the first time we ever see grace, gift, in the whole story is here, in Genesis 1:1. This also is a gift. Existence is a gift. Being created is a gift. The fact that the universe was born in the first place is a gift. It is a kind of grace, and that's because it didn't need to happen. And yet, here it is, and here you and I are. I can't stress this enough in terms of how important this is in terms of a Christian understanding of the world and a Christian understanding of, in terms of how we engage the world, and in terms of understanding God's goodness and his generosity, which I think, by the way, blows up most of our social and cultural sort of assumptions, because Christians are those whose posture towards the world is this is a gift given to exist, to have been created, meaning we're always the receivers on the story and in this story. And I'm not saying there that we are passive, right? We still have agency as those who are receivers on this side or in this story. But being receivers in this story means a couple things. One of the things that being a receiver ultimately in this story means is we shouldn't pretend that we bought this. Being a receiver in the story means that we shouldn't pretend that we made all of this, or that we accomplished this, or that we created this ourselves. The Christian way of being in the world, the posture that we take in being in this world, is one of thanksgiving. It is one of gratitude. It is one of worship. Now, there will be those in our culture who suggest that the reason we should be thankful is tied to something a little bit different. What do I mean by this? Well, some people say the reason we should be thankful in this world is because things don't last, right? We think about this when it comes to, say, a flower, right? The reason a flower is beautiful is because it's going to wilt, does not last. The reason a sandcastle is so precious is because another wave will come and it will clear the canvas for another sandcastle. You hear this when people come up to you that have already had kids in their home and they tell you, you know, it's this moment, just hang on to it, it's so precious. It doesn't last. Be thankful in the moment. And the reason our culture says we are to be thankful in the moment is because things do not last. And so we say the beauty and the thanksgiving and the gratitude we should have is because everything will one day, even including people, die. And sometimes this is, by the way, used against Christians. So for example, some people will speak of Christians as those who can't really care for this world because all they think about is going to the next world. And this is true. There are some Christians who could care less about this place, and there are Christians who see this place as going to hell in a handbasket. And so what does it matter, right? Just take me home, dear Jesus, right? Like, just have your faith in Jesus and get out of this place as soon as possible. So, but there are Christians like that in this way. So sometimes people will accuse Christians of those who they only think about life after death, so there's no way they could really care for this place. They could never really care for the environment, care for this world, care for the earth, care for the people in it. But regardless if this is even correct, that just because something doesn't last is the reason we should think something is precious or beautiful. This story starts with someone who intentionally created it. This story starts with a personality who, out of his goodness and love, on purpose made something that didn't need to be, gifted it, and we're the receivers of that, and it's not by accident. So it's not actually clear to me how, like, a naturalist or a naturalistic sort of materialist view could actually claim a better appreciation for this world. In fact, I think that is on the side of this story in terms of beauty and intentionality and meaning, and purpose. I actually think it's the other folks who have more explaining to do. When someone says, I should care for this world and the environment, but it all got here by chance. I should care for this place and this world and the stuff in it, but we don't know why. It's just random. Like, it's just a mixture of sort of things that happen over time in history, and I guess it's not going to last. And we all know it's not going to last. It's either going to all die off due to a cool-off, or it's going to just blow up in some kind of explosion. Even scientists speak of this, right? I think it's on them to explain why I should care for the environment if this is all here by chance, if this is all here by accident, if there's no real meaning to it, except that it's kind of precious because it won't last. Why should I care if it's just here and it's here by accident? In fact, you know, there can be pride in our individual lives, but there is something in the Bible that speaks of collective pride. And so maybe it's precisely because we'll never be able to calculate this. No physicist will ever be able to calculate why there's a universe rather than no universe. No physicist will ever be able to calculate why we have life rather than no life. And maybe that's why we've all collectively turned our back on the giver, because we can't explain it. Maybe that's why we've rejected our posture as thankful receivers. By the way, this isn't just a philosophical thing if you feels that way right now. We see this sort of one-circle way of viewing reality in our world in other ways, meaning there's nothing outside of this. We see it in our culture. The Bible, of course, speaks of a great giver, which then immediately results in us being thankful receivers. But there are other one-circle ways of viewing this world, where there's no God who is providing. One of those is a one-circle market paradigm, where we are ultimately and no more than producers and consumers. This also, by the way, shows up in ancient religions, so where people barter with the gods, made in sort of their image, but basically, I'll scratch the gods' backs and they'll scratch my back in the temples, or I'll provide and barter with the gods and trade with them by giving them something, some resources, and they'll give me something sort of back. But it's not just in ancient culture that we see this. We see this in non-religious contexts as well. Obviously, we see this in corporate culture. That shouldn't surprise. But now it even controls the rest of our lives, right? Our private lives. This isn't new to me. I didn't come up with this. Our philosophers have been talking about it for a while. We don't just live in a market economy, though we have a market economy. We also live in what's known as a market society. And what does that mean, a market society? Well, market society is everything can be bought. Everything can be sold. Everything has a price. Anything can be negotiated. Anything can be turned into a brand. This includes love. This includes relationships. This includes security. This includes our identity. Literally, a world where all of our relationships can be bought, sold, put online, monetized, YouTube. Right now, when a friend wants to talk, it's over a podcast, something like this, right? Relationships, all of these things with family, with partners, everything can be calculated and to bring a profit. Though we would rarely want to name this truth out loud. This was reminded, this came up a couple of years ago when I was talking to an older couple who had retired, and they lived in a place for their whole lives. They had built all these relationships, and they built all of these businesses, and they built and their family was from there, and their whole life and all their connections and their community were from this same location. And then they moved to a completely new location where no family was, no connections, nothing. And I said, do you miss it at all? No. No. Because everything can be exchanged. Everything. Don't miss it a bit. Meaning we've become a society where you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. Where the strong, those who don't need caregiving, or the youth, either be babies or the elderly, those who have nothing to exchange, those who don't have discretionary time to build enough capital, they are left behind. We've literally dragged all of life, the gift of God's creation, all of it, onto a balance sheet, where now everything has a price. Everything has a certain value, and anything can be exchanged for anything else. And the reason I bring this up is because this way of viewing the world, right, a one-circle sort of market society way of viewing the world, it really can't cope or make sense of some things that just are, just given. One of those is nature. Nature just unfolding with no purpose, no goal. Well, we would say in a two-circle view, the goal would be to bring glory and honor to God. A prairie filled with flowers, wildflowers. This bear sitting on this tree branch, unfolding purely for its own sake, without thought, without goal. Think of the birds, Jesus, if you remember, says. The one circle view of the world, or market society view of the world, can't fathom life as gift. It can't. And thus it needs to turn everything into efficiency, profit. We see this especially in things like art, by the way. Those very paintings, pieces of pottery, crafts of glorious and pointless beauty. I can't tell you how many times somebody has seen something Annie has made, or something like a painting or a craft, or something somebody else has made, a piece of, you know, wood carved, or a pottery turned, where somebody, just listen for it, have you ever thought of starting a business? Somebody that's very good at photography, have you ever thought of starting something with this? Have you ever heard of Etsy? No, I've never heard of it. As if beauty, as if the purpose of these things are to be a means to an end. You should start a business. Now, certainly, unless you live under a rock, nature and art can both be monetized. Anybody hear of waterfront property? Traded. But, and this is why I bring it up, the obscene prices asked for, clamored for these rare fine prints, or the ugly consequences of privatizing parks, privatizing land, privatizing nature, they just simply are reminders of this one-circle view of the world. Those who have a one-circle view of the world, or what we would call a market society, have little ability to understand things that are just given. They're just gift. And purely for those sake, and that sake. And this story, laughs at such one-circle market views of the world. And here's why I say that. What deal are you ever going to sit down at the table with God and cut with him? The God who gives everything already. The Bible never portrays us as wheelers and dealers at the corporate boardroom table with God, making a deal with him in order to get ahead. Do you know how we're portrayed in this story in Genesis 1:1 from the beginning in Acts 17? Paul makes this clear. We're portrayed as receivers from the start. We're portrayed as those who are dependent. We are literally portrayed as children on Christmas morning receiving unnecessarily lavish and abundant gifts from God. And by the way, without any contractual obligations. Imagine if there was a contractual obligation for your heart to beat, or for your air, like your breath. Like if God said, no, sign here. No, there are no contractual obligations to breathe. There are no contractual obligations for your heart to pulse. There are no contractual obligations to exist. And I'm bringing this up because this will become very, very important when we get to what Christ has done on our behalf. Because when it comes to the good news of Jesus, there are no contractual obligations for our salvation. And it was there from the beginning, and it's pointed to in the beginning. And if you follow that all the way to the core of what reality is, it yields, or it should have, but that's for another day, it yields a very different world. One where the poor, one where the weak, where the aged aren't set aside. Why are they set aside in our culture? Because they can't scratch our back anymore. Because they can't put food on the table. They cannot produce, and nor are they efficient. Instead, if we go to existence as gift, they would be cared for. They would be honored. And the reason for that is because God has always given freely to those who cannot stand on their own two feet. And this story, a two-circle way of understanding the world, life as a gift given by a distinct God, I think gives the most compelling argument and reason for a society of compassion. And it's a society of love and helping those in need. Even helping those, by the way, who can't pay us back. How are we ever going to pay God back? Or, and these are the hardest people to serve, helping those who are ungrateful. Those are the hardest to deal with. But then ask yourself, are you grateful and filled with gratitude every moment of the day. I would argue, because if you're anything like me, no. And yet you exist. He gives life, and he keeps giving it, and he keeps giving it, and he keeps giving it. Ironically, both views, the two-circle view, God the great giver who provided us this place, and the one-circle market society view, they both have excess and abundance at the core of their story, just in opposite directions. In the story of a distinct God who's given us everything, including our existence, it plunges us, even though he didn't have to, it plunges us into the bottomless ocean of generosity, God's generosity, God's provisions, his grace, setting us ultimately free to be thanksgiving worshipers. And it's not so clear to me that a one-circle view, this is all there is but market society, where there is no giver, only limitless overproduction, only limitless consumption, only limitless accumulation, it's not clear to me that that can provide or even has the power to do the same, offer the same kind of freedom. Would you please pray with me? Our Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, God, we bless your name. With thankfulness and without hesitation, we declare you're the one who gives life. You're the one who has provided us breath, existence, a heartbeat, without any contractual obligations. We didn't have to be, and yet here we are. This didn't have to be, and yet here we are. You are the one who has kept the universe since birth. You are the one who has kept each and every one of us since birth. And right now, you are keeping us and caring for us. And so, God, we praise your name. And we worship your name. And we adore your name. And we yield our life by your Spirit over to you with glad thanksgiving and with gratitude in our hearts. We pray this in Jesus' name. And all of God's people say, amen.